welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking to Tawanda Jones, whose brother was murdered by the Baltimore police. And we're going to be talking quite a bit today about what life is really like in Gaza. And also the big story that we got to get to before we can move on. And that is the fairly shocking news that FBI Director James Comey was dismissed yesterday evening by President Donald Trump, allegedly for his mishandling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email system. And this move, with this move, Trump has deepened the political crisis, swirling around the FBI investigation into whatever ties there were or were not between Trump campaign officials and agents of the Russian government. And it's taken another turn just before this show that perhaps the Justice Department is disputing this, but that James Comey had asked for more money to speed up the investigation or to do more or something like that. And so nevertheless, it raises to a higher level the issue of meddling by Trump in this FBI investigation into the so-called or alleged Russian meddling. So we're pretty far down the rabbit hole on this entire cloud of potential foreign involvement in the election. And it seems somewhat remarkable that the Trump administration would even do this, given the relatively easy to predict reaction that can only make things worse for Trump and his team, who vehemently dispute any sort of collusion with Russia in the election in the first place. And Democrats are, acting remarkably hypocritical, given their intense criticism of Comey's actions regarding the Clinton email saga. Many of them had actually called for his firing before, but now many of them are saying that this was a bad thing and that he shouldn't be fired for the thing they wanted him fired for. So the stage is now set for a fairly major clash over whether or not a special prosecutor should be appointed to lead the investigation into the allegations of Russian involvement in the elections, something that would have to come from the Trump administration and that most Republicans have resisted so far. However, it appears more and more Republicans are coming on board with this idea. John McCain, Justin Amash came out saying that they believe there should be a special prosecutor. And just so there's just a little more fuel poured on these flames, today Trump and Rex Tillerson are meeting with Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Telling you, you could make this stuff up if you wanted to. It seems the only real inference you can draw as to why the Trump administration did this are that A, they are so confident there is nothing to the Russia probe, they don't care how it looks now. B, they know there is something to the Russia probe and they're trying to in some way derail it. Or C, just extremely amateur PR strategies. Now, based on Politico's reporting, which was somewhat first out of the gate here and very extensive, from some unnamed sources inside the administration, it was some combination of B or C that Trump – or B and C, I should say – that Trump was angry about the inability of the White House to control the narrative on the Russia probe issue, and that given Democrats and Republicans alike had some issues with Comey, it wouldn't really be a huge deal, although there's also this issue of Roger Stone, who's out there saying that he's been trying to pressure Trump to fire Comey for weeks. So who knows what was really going on behind the scenes. So at this point, all we can really say about the Comey firing is that the optics of it look pretty bad, pretty much no matter what they did, why they did what they did. It just looks like a pretty dumb play, and Comey looks like still could testify this week in front of the Senate hearing looking into this Russia investigation here. But there's really more to it than just this dumb political move in terms of the underpinning of the whole conversation. Now, many are drawing significantly overplayed analogies to Nixon during Watergate, which, quite frankly, are not that helpful and ahistorical, although it's easy to see why, since the general drift of what's happening seems to have raised the potential of impeachment well into the zone of possibility. But this is where we need to step back. The idea that this is a Nixonian-level cover-up and that Trump is headed towards impeachment comes from what has become conventional wisdom for establishment Democrats and most of the media, which is that Trump did indeed collude with Russia to defeat Clinton. Most coverage of this issue assumes that this is a matter of the extent of this so-called collusion and whether or not the different connections reach the level of criminal activity, which doesn't necessarily have the same burden. Outside of the ideologically motivated right-wing press, it's difficult to find any sort of attempt to question these conclusions. The New York Times, for instance, categorically stated in its editorial on the Comey firing that he was fired to stop the Russia investigation. So we hate to have to repeat this, but the Russia investigation so far has been more or less underwhelming based on the openly available information. We should restate here that there is no proof of the direct collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government that anyone has seen yet. And in fact, several of the anonymous sources that have spoken to major media outlets have outright denied there was direct collusion, just quote-unquote contacts. Further, Sally Yates, who's the liberal establishment hero of the month, did not state there was direct collusion, simply that Michael Flynn had acted in a duplicitous way in terms of his disclosures to the Trump team regarding Russia that she felt he could be blackmailed for, although she did say there's some things that she wouldn't go into that are classified or whatever. So taking stock of all the available evidence, and again, this is why we've been calling the whole time for all of this stuff to be released, but either way, regarding the issue of Trump and Russia, it seems like the picture here is somewhat clear now in terms of what took place. Trump, the candidate, professed for almost entire his campaign that he wanted to have closer relations between the U.S. and Russia, particularly in the fight against ISIS, but not exclusively. Now, if we reported to you before, for sure, this actually – it was a widely held view for some time in the U.S., German, French, and Italian business world where the Obama-era sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine conflict were initially seen as counterproductive. However, they went through. They were aggressively promoted by the U.S. foreign policy establishment that is universally hawkish towards Russia. So all the big foreign policy experts, Republicans included, they flocked to Hillary Clinton as the last best hope for neocon-style aggression against Russia and Syria. Many of these people, like Robert Kagan, openly stated that's why they preferred Clinton. So Trump draws to him a rogues gallery of, well, who was left? As in terms of foreign policy advisors, Flynn, who is a foreign policy establishment person but sort of a maverick, wanted to ally with Russia against ISIS, and it seems perhaps trying to isolate Iran from Russia, given Flynn's obsession with Iran as the main enemy. Paul Manafort, an old Washington hand with ties to all sorts of foreign governments and businesses, including in Eastern Europe, who also presumably saw Russia and the U.S. as allies, not enemies. Carter Page, some sort of social climber, businessman, come policy analyst who supports closer relations with Russia. And Roger Stone, well, who actually knows what's going on with him. So it's not really that strange. Pick any issue of substance for any country in the world, and many Americans who advocate for closer relations with this or that country or this or that issue have various ties to this or that country. There is a massive influence peddling operation done by many foreign countries in Washington, D.C., both above and below ground. So it really is not evidence of collusion or wrongdoing that a candidate who wanted better relations with Russia was being advised by people who agree with him and who have business, social, and political ties to Russia, which is exactly what you'd expect if they wanted closer ties, and maybe some of the people they talked to were secret government agents. Okay, fine. But again, not evidence of collusion. So the question is, did any of this basically par for the course in official Washington behavior rise to the level of criminality? Certainly possible, but who knows? So why is all this important, and why did I take the time to review that? Because what's happening here is clear, and it has been from the beginning. Elements of the national security establishment are using this opportunity to stampede the country into a more bellicose stance towards Russia, something that's entirely clear by how much Sputnik and RT are mentioned in Senate investigations that allegedly are probing secret collusion between the Russian government, not media outlets discussing things every other media outlet is discussing, to a vastly larger audience of Americans. Democrats looking for scapegoats for Hillary Clinton's poor campaigning have supercharged this in a major way to distract from anything other than their own failures. The two things combined have created a toxic witch hunt-like atmosphere that has totally distorted important conversations about America's foreign policy with the other major nuclear power and a major player in many conflicts on the world stage at a time where clearly the stakes around world peace and nuclear war could not be higher. So ultimately, it's crucial we keep all this in perspective as the special prosecutor situation moves forward. The actual issues that could actually save lives and decrease tensions around the world if the U.S. and Russia have better dialogue don't deserve to be overshadowed by unproven theories that have clearly outkicked their coverage. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And as we continue our conversation about this Trump-Comey saga, I guess you could call it, we're very happy to be joined by Danny McAdams, who's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Mr. McAdams, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No, of course. And so obviously lots of news sort of coming out fast and quick here, but maybe your just initial impressions on the firing of James Comey by Donald Trump.
Well, I think it's pretty funny that Washington is all up in arms. I can't help but be amused at all the Democrats who just a month ago or less were tweeting that he must be fired. Now that he is actually fired, They're saying it's a constitutional crisis and that Trump has to be investigated even more because of it. So I think it just shows you how political and politicized the whole thing is. The FBI has, from its inception, been a politicized organization. It should be no surprise that whether the director is Comey or anyone else, it's a politicized thing. So I think, in a sense, it's the kind of crisis that Washington loves, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really amount to very much.
I think that's it's a very certainly relevant point. I mean, I think the New York Times in their editorial this morning was like, yeah, we know that we did actually call, for Comey to be fired. But, and I'm just like, oh, great. So, like, now that he actually did what you wanted, you don't like it. But, I mean, it does seem to me that sort of the ball is rolling downhill on this. I mean, do you think that there is a chance? I mean, I know Mitch McConnell has come out saying he will not do this. But do you think there's a chance here that waiting in the wings, we could see some sort of independent counsel, Ken Starr sort of situation pop up here?
Well, that's what some people are calling for. Even some Republicans are calling for it. You know, and it's a pretty foolish idea. I mean, I guess the whole idea is that now we've essentially the narrative that they're pushing is that Trump fired Comey because Comey's investigation of Russian influence in the elections was getting close to having a smoking gun. And the whole thing is completely absurd because Trump fired Comey. He fired the head of the FBI. He didn't fire the FBI. There are still dozens, if not hundreds, of FBI agents still looking into this. The fact that he fired the head of it means absolutely nothing. And the whole idea that Trump would do something that would focus attention on the Russian issue more than anything else as a way of diverting attention from it, It's so ridiculous and so fallacious that if anyone in Washington had a brain, they'd laugh at it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it just sort of seems like the subtext of all of this is there seems to just be – it's almost like the sort of Russia, quote-unquote, collusion issue has already been litigated in a court or something the way it's being written about, because it seems like so much of this momentum to we must have a special prosecutor, we must have this, is really sort of an underlying assumption, at least in the media, that Trump is basically guilty of this, and it's just a question of when and how much, not if, this took place.
Exactly. And the question is and remains, what exactly did Russia do? Nobody has answered that question. Did they hack the voting booths? Well, no one is saying that. Well, what did they do? Oh, they had RT. So somehow RT, this relatively small TV station, and Sputnik, okay, they had these couple of things that most Americans don't listen to. Somehow they must have had the greatest influence campaign in history if they were able to turn Americans into Trump voters from being Hillary voters. It's absurd. I would just like someone to tell me what the Russians actually did. Well, they wanted to undermine confidence in our institutions. Sorry, Washington has already undermined our confidence in the institutions. They've done it all themselves.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it seems like the other piece to this now with the Lavrov meetings happening in D.C. is what's being overshadowed to me and why to some degree this is so dangerous in terms of how it's raising the temperature is, you know, they're discussing Syria and probably some other things. So, you know, lives could be saved if America was using more diplomacy, not just with Russia, but other countries. And here we are in a situation where no one is talking about that. No one is pressuring one way or the other. The whole thing is just about the FBI and James Comey and Russia. So the only thing people can talk about with Sergei Lavrov is this absurd theory that, like, this somehow confirms that there's Russia collusion. And it's just like, man, like, there are real issues, real people dying in the world, and we're actually maybe undermining the processes that could approach and deal with that.
Well, we discussed this issue on today's Ron Paul Liberty Report, and one of the questions we raised is, how does the deep state benefit from everyone being focused on this non-issue? And look at some of the things that we should be talking about. As you point out, Afghanistan, the U.S. is poised to really ramp up its ground troops there. The U.S. is ready to give heavy weapons to the Kurds in Syria. How will the Turks take that? As you point out, the meeting with Lavrov today, the possible rapprochement over a Syrian solution, nobody's talking about that. Ongoing monetary crisis, economic crisis, nobody's talking about. So really, there is a benefit to the deep state, the people talking about this Comey non-issue.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And it seems like that's just kind of been the theme from the beginning and sort of like a cui bono sort of piece is the people who seem to be benefiting the most from this entire thing are these intelligence agencies that were becoming more and more discredited for so often having misled us, having the CIA at least have hacked into Congress, the NSA, you know, hacking into every single person's communications on the planet Earth. I mean, like all these people who were being widely denounced by people across the spectrum for their abuses now all of a sudden have been elevated to sort of like angelic level.
Yeah, and including in the FBI itself. One of the things we said on our show today was, let's get rid of the FBI too, not just Comey, because this is an organization that never should have been formed. There's nothing in the Constitution to allow us to have a national police force. Congress initially tried to prohibit Teddy Roosevelt from forming the FBI, and he sort of snuck around them. They gained a lot of power through World War I, prosecuting people who criticized the government's involvement in war. And from then on out, they've been involved in monitoring Americans, monitoring the peace movement, monitoring Martin Luther King Jr., incinerating 80 people in Waco, Texas. They have a terrible, terrible track record, and they're increasingly militarized. So why do we have them at all is the question.
Yeah, no, I think that is a very good point. I mean, it's actually an interesting subtext just about all these agencies from the CIA to the FBI about how through a lot of these processes, especially war. I'm glad you mentioned the World War I piece. They gain all these powers that aren't, you know, sort of really laid out anywhere, but then sort of the precedent comes out and then people act as if, you know, in 1787, they set up the FBI, the CIA, and the Department of Defense, and like this is just completely sacrosanct and nothing can change.
Yeah, and what the FBI enforces, more or less, are the 300,000 regulations. They're not laws, they're regulations. Everything from the EPA to the FDA and so on that are criminally enforced. And this is what they do. They say the average American commits 3 felonies a day. Well, that's because there are too many laws on the book. There are too many regulations on the book that people go to jail for. That's the real problem. But they have incentive to expand these because it gives them even more power.
Yeah, no, for sure. That is the case. And perhaps, you know, one of the things that I think we have to just be quite concerned about moving forward here, that maybe the end result of this entire sort of Trump-Russia episode, I mean, who knows, maybe the end result will be that they find their smoking gun and whoever, but let's just assume that they don't, that we've just drastically reintroduced here this intense sort of almost imperial power in the executive. I mean, I don't know what you think about that, but it seems like just a dangerous side effect.
Well, it's been the past, you know, several presidents. I guess you could go back to the last 100 years if you wanted to. But certainly that process seems to have accelerated under G.W. Bush and Obama and now Trump. The idea that Congress is completely supine, it completely bows down to the president. And, you know, as I pointed out earlier, when Teddy Roosevelt tried to create the FBI, Congress actually stood up and said, no, they're going to start acting against the Constitution if you create this group. So that's when we actually had a real Congress that took its duties seriously as really the first branch, the people's branch of government. Until Congress wakes up and starts defending us against this out-of-control executive, we're going to slip further and further into dictatorship.
And that, I think, is a great point to leave it on. And thank you so much for joining us. That was Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And we are going to take a break on that note here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, and as you may know, Donald Trump at the end of this month is going to visit Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Vatican of all places. So in the lead up to that, we're trying to cover some of the politics as they concern most of those areas. And today we want to talk especially on Gaza, but maybe a little bit broader as it concerns the Palestinian issue. And we are very happy to be joined in our studio by three great guests. We have Rami Aman, who's a Palestinian activist, Jamal Ashour, who's a Palestinian artist and student, and Dan Cohen, who's a filmmaker and journalist as well. Both Rami and Jamal are from Gaza. Dan has been there, so we have the actual experts here in the house. Thank you all for joining the show.
Good to be with you, Gene.
Good to be with you, too.
To be with you, too, also.
So, Rami, I'll start with you, and I'm kind of curious what all you guys think about this question is, you know, I was thinking about this today. We talked about this a little off air. This is day 24 of the Palestinian hunger strike. And I just thought it was interesting how, you know, it's no news in America. Like, they covered day one and it's not another issue. And I always wonder, for Palestinians especially, coming to America, how does the coverage of what's going on over there strike you? I mean, is it non-existent, misleading? I mean, how do you feel when you see what Americans are getting in terms of what's going on with the Palestinian people?
First of all, thank you so much to give us the chance and to talk here in this radio. And yes, we are not that good to covering our news, especially when we're talking about the Palestinian news, because it's Israeli blockade and the Palestinian division. But really, it's very hard that any news can go out from Gaza Strip. You know, many channels and many agendas working in this Palestinian land. And because of that, we are missing the independent journalist. Yes, maybe there is some journalist came to Gaza and covering the news, but they are can't go to Gaza every time. Israel can't leave them go to Gaza, forbidden all the time. But we have more brave journalists like that than I met then in the last year. And the small world, yeah, told me that. I can't imagine. You don't tell me that you have done in the radio. And yes, we are suffering in Gaza Strip, suffering from many cases, from our as Palestinians and from all the world and from Israelis also. But we are not that good to expand our news. Not us, not the, just us, we are the Palestinians. Yes, maybe there are a lot of Arab words don't have the foreigner channel that they can covering their news. But we as Palestinians, you know, in our blood, we expanding our problems, we are expanding our stories. You will know more with from Jamal, because he is suffering in all his life, and especially in his 5 or 6 years from how we can travel to America. For me, I'm already a journalist and I'm already an activist. And my work that talking with the people, networking, talking about Palestinian issues, and also and because the Palestinian division, we are suffering that we don't have one Palestinian news. Many news covering related to the agendas. Palestinian party, even the world's agenda.
Well, Jamal, I'm curious what you think about this. And you're also a student, as I mentioned, so I assume you're probably interacting with a lot of folks here in America. I mean, how do you, I mean, do you find people are not knowledgeable and you're sort of having to re-educate a lot of people, that the coverage is skewed? I mean, how do you, I guess really more of my question is being a Palestinian coming to America where this issue is so kind of presented really just in one way. I mean, how does that affect you when, you know, you're seeing what people are seeing and interacting with?
When I look at the picture where I came from, how it's presented here, there's so many things like going on, lots of what happening there, lots of people which covering, lots of people covering too many stories going two different ways. People do not know what's going on. People know, but sometimes the story is missing. Sometimes the focus is different. Maybe one part is more focused on. I was surprised that our story like wasn't not that good presented when I came here. I came here right after the war, and most of the stories was focused on the other side, on the Israeli stories. There's too many people. I know there is like it's too complicated and there is too violence both ways and stuff like this. But at least I wasn't seeing any.
Any balance, really.
Any balance coverage. Where, like, it is the story where welfare, like, it's fair shared, you know? At least, like, we don't say who's right, who's wrong. At least, like, you can show what's going on.
Right, right.
And also, of course, folks here, like, well, sometimes they ask me, what is Palestine or where is Gaza? It's so complicated.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Dan, I'm curious. I mean, you are from the United States, and you've been traveling back and forth to Gaza. You're working on a movie. You've done a lot of reporting. So, I mean, I'm curious as how this issue strikes you coming sort of from that perspective, since, you know, CNN, I don't think, is having you on every day when you come back to say what you're seeing.
Right. I mean, as much as Palestinians in Gaza are under siege and blockade, there's like kind of a psychological siege and blockade and information blockade in this country. So we get very little and skewed information coming from Gaza, so we don't really know what's happening there. I think for one thing, a lot of Americans would struggle to find Gaza on a map in the first place. But I mean, this point was really driven home for me on the last couple nights of the war in 2014, when I spent one of these nights as 14 story towers are coming down around me. Israel is bombing these things with bunker busters and just taking down Gaza's major assets. And I spent the night, you know, watching this from the seventh floor of a media tower in Gaza City. And, you know, this is one of the most terrifying nights of my life. And as the sun comes up and the bombing stops, there are like dozens of Palestinian journalists who pour in from the streets and were on the ground covering that stuff all night. And maybe a little bit of video footage would come out of Gaza. But I mean, there's a huge infrastructure in Gaza of journalists who are really brave and doing, you know, brilliant work, that they're just not, they're being excluded. They're not talked about. At the same time, you know, I spent a lot of time in Gaza after the war showing, you know, through reporting, video reports, and actually, you know, gathering footage for the documentary Killing Gaza that my colleague Max Blumenthal and I are finishing up. And this type of stories that I would see, you know, just really devastating things. I saw like families, their children burning to death. I saw babies freezing to death, people just really living in unimaginable conditions. And none of that came out. And I couldn't get anyone to like pick this stuff up, you know, just my reports from Mondo Weiss. And then there was a film festival in the rubble in Shijaiya. This is one of the neighborhoods that is like the most devastated. These huge neighborhoods are just completely gone. And they had this film festival where they rolled out this red carpet. I mean, just stunning, visually stunning. And I put this photo online and it went viral, like it blew up. And CNN actually reached out to me, and, you know, which indicates to me that they're seeing my reporting, they're seeing something, they just choose not to. And so because it was like this photo that was, you know, kind of iconic and uplifting, that maybe they would use it, but then they declined to even do that.
Tells you so much. And I really just kind of wanted to set that scene in some ways for our listeners, because I think people oftentimes in this country aren't even aware of how skewed the cover, even if people are sort of aware that they're not getting the whole story, I think a lot of times they don't understand, you know, how much else there is to talk about. So now to get into the controversial stuff here. So, you know, the big news that I think we've seen here in the international press, Rami, involving Gaza in particular, well, involving Palestine, but I think referencing Gaza to some degree, is the new Hamas political document and this idea of you know, whether or not this is going to be able to perhaps break the deadlock in negotiations. So if you want to comment on that, certainly feel free to comment on what you think about that, whether or not it's going to change that issue. But I think the underlying issue I'm also curious your thoughts on is sort of the way the conflict is presented in America is, and I think many countries, is sort of a conflict between two factions. But as anyone who knows the issue knows, I mean, not only are there multiple political parties, but there's grassroots organizations and things like that. So I was hoping maybe you could just talk a little bit as well about how the struggle, the Palestinian struggle, is more than just sort of, you know, Israel and two political parties fighting each other.
Let me talk first about Hamas' new document. For my opinion, there is no change in Hamas' opinion, but because of the media, maybe now understand Hamas very well. Since 20 years, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the head of Hamas, he said also we can recognize as two states start from 1967 borders, one state for the Palestinian and another state for the Israeli, and without recognition about Israel. That's what Hamas said. But nowadays, you know, after Hamas won in the last election in 2006, all the focus from all the world is starting to know Hamas. Hamas also now in 2017, not as Hamas 2006, not as Hamas 1987. Hamas now looking to share and leading all of the Palestinian Authority. Maybe Hamas in the past just was a small movement talking about resistance, talking about fighting with Israel. But now when Hamas in the government, they change a lot of the way in the talking with the world, especially when they are in Gaza Strip. Sometimes they talked with many foreign officials, ambassadors came from all of the world, from Europe, from and we are missing that Americans visit Gaza. No American official came to Gaza. But at the same time, Qatar also, Turkey, many of the political in the world came to Gaza and discussed with Hamas about everything. Also, when Hamas negotiate with other parties of Germany about Gilad Shalit, Hamas was very open-minded nowadays. Also in Gaza Strip, now we feel that. Yes, maybe because the situation, in it's very, 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 very hard in Gaza Strip, and Hamas said that we are, since 2006, we are under blockade. We are won in the last elections, and Mr. George W. Bush made a very big veto over Gaza Strip that we will never recognize in this result. But for me, no, it's not fair. The Islamic won in Tunis, the Islamic won in Egypt, the Islamic won in Libya, and there is no blockade over these countries. Why Gaza? Yes, there is a division between Hamas and between Fatah, and it's internal issue, internal Palestinian issue, and I think that's very hard for us as Palestinians. Now we should unite our country, and then we should talk with all of the world. That's my opinion. I can't talk about any negotiating with the world and negotiate with Israel. I need a new document for the reconciliation. I don't need any new document to talk about
other political
issue. I need a new document to talk about the Palestinian reconciliation. And because of these issues, nobody in the world cares about us. Go and solve your problem, and then came to us. As Mr. Trump said, as Netanyahu said all the time for Mahmoud Abbas, for all of them, Mahmoud Abbas, are you president or over Palestine or just West Bank, about Gaza? At the same time, they're talking with Hamas. Are you controlling Gaza or over Palestine?
Well, Jamal, I'm curious what you think about this. You know, you grew up in Gaza. You've seen the situation there. Your family, obviously, is still there. I mean, how are you seeing – I mean, do you think any – changes are going to come from this document, or is it more or less status quo and there are other issues that have to be addressed more sort of pertinently for the Palestinians on the ground?
Well, the Hamas Fateh or Hamas authority issue will be, I guess, long story, so complicated. But as Rami said, indeed, like, it is representing us like in two different ways, confusing people around us, especially in politics. Well, both parties, I believe, are wrong. Fighting whatever the reasons are, there is people suffering between, stuck. They are both problem. And as Rami said, we don't care about negotiation with one part of both of them. We believe who's wrong, who's wrong. We just believe in one, like once we unite our parties, then we can talk about the rest of it with the rest of the world, you know. Like, really, basically, I really don't care what both presents for the world as long as they are fighting.
No, I certainly hear you. I think that around the world, even in the black population in America, the issue of sort of national unity against those who are coming at you is so key. And I'm curious, Dan, I mean, having just sort of been there and sort of seeing the way it's playing out, I mean, it does seem that there is sort of, I mean, I'm curious your thoughts in general, how you think this might affect the overall circumstance, but also too, just kind of like, I think a just misunderstanding that there's so much going on in terms of Palestinian civil society, maybe one of the most active in the world, and we only kind of hear about the high level players.
Right. Well, I think what these guys are talking about is correct, that for Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank and just, you know, throughout Palestine, unity is kind of the most important issue in terms of overthrowing occupation and liberation, getting liberation. And the infighting between Hamas and Fatah has been absolutely detrimental and plays perfectly into Israel's goal of divide and conquer. At least, I mean, in terms of on the outside, I think basically that Hamas is showing by getting rid of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory language that was a weakness in its original charter, and bringing in language that reflects the Palestinian consensus and reality that it is ultimately a political conflict, not a religious conflict. I think that's important, and I think it shows that Hamas is pragmatic. So if Israel actually wanted a partner for peace, it could certainly do it with Hamas. But Israel is the occupier. Israel is, you know, the one getting $3.8 billion this year from the U.S. for weapons. Israel is the one in charge, in control. So kind of it's almost it doesn't really matter so much what Hamas does in that sense. It could be, you know, it could be extreme or it could be moderate. And Israel's just not interested in negotiations. Israel wants Hamas to rule Gaza because it can effectively do that.
That is quite interesting, I think. And you know, one thing I'm curious about, this is sort of slightly shifting gears, although, of course, anyone feel free to say anything in response to what Dan said as well. But one thing I'm also curious about, Jamal, that I think that, I mean, not only am I curious, I think a lot of people wonder, you know, what's the most difficult thing about living in Gaza under blockade, under occupation, like the day-to-day? Because I think a lot of what I see in the U.S. media that's really being perpetrated by Israel is that, well, it's not that hard to live there. You know what I mean? And these people are just overplaying how bad it is, and it's the whatever, whatever, whatever. So, I mean, just in sort of like the day-to-day, I mean, obviously, I know there's so many things. What are some of just the difficulties, frustrations of everyday life in these conditions?
Well, if I'm going to look at the situation from like, if I want to zoom out and get into the situation, I will see there is no electricity. There is no water. Mm-hmm. If there is a water, it is dirty or salty. There is no movement outside or going, like, you're stuck. You're under siege. Employment, economy is zero. We have a huge Islamic propaganda. You cannot say what you want. You cannot wear what you want. There's some certain level of freedom, but you cannot, for example, publish an article you want to write, or you cannot, rappers there, for example, they cannot rap whatever they want. Every 2 years or like once it gets really politically like confusing between the parties there and they are stuck, there is a war. I've been living in since I was 5 years old until I got out of Gaza. I have never seen a peaceful time. Like after 2000, the first Intifada, until 2014, until I got out of Gaza during the last war, like 2014, every 2 years it was like a slash of. For example, like, as I grew up as a kid, like, I'm sure I have a psychological problem, you know what I mean? Like, children see too many stuff, like, they find themselves born in this, like, conflict for no reason, propaganda, no electricity, no water, they are not treated as human beings, and they see all the world around them, like, living normally. Even if they want to watch the Israeli TV, which is, like, 1 hour away from them, it's a whole different world. You know?
Well,
when you wake up, there is no electricity, there is no water, there is no money because you're employed. I was lucky because I was like at least like middle class, but there is a huge poverty there. About 90% people, like 90% of the people, they don't have money, or they have money, or like after the issue of the siege. Mm-hmm. Too many problems. It's so complicated.
It is. We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back with more with all our guests on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation here about what it's really like in Gaza, what's going on there, and some issues in the Palestinian struggle, which is obviously in the wake of Donald Trump, whose first visit outside of the U.S. borders is going to be to Israel at the end of this month of May. We continue to be joined by Jamal Ashour, who's a Palestinian artist and student, Rami Aman, who's a Palestinian activist, and Dan Cohen, who's a filmmaker and journalist who spent quite a bit of time in Gaza. And so, Rami, I wanted to come to you. We left off chatting with Jamal about, you know, what it really is like and sort of the everyday piece. You're getting ready to return to Gaza here, I think, in a very short amount of time. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the same issue. I mean, just some of the basic challenges it takes not only to live, but also to engage in political activity as well.
Okay, let me talk something about the history. Mm-hmm. Gaza Strip occupied since 1967. There is also other war between Israel and Egypt and Gaza suffering in 1973. Mm. In 1987, the first intifada and the Israeli operations inside Gaza Strip and killing the worker and killing the people. In 1993, the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza Strip, and we signed the Gaza Ariha agreement between us and between Israelis. In 1996, the Israelis continue attacking the Palestinians in Jerusalem, and at the same time in Gaza Strip, we are suffering from all of the area inside Palestine. In 2000, the second intifada. In 2006, there is also when Israel gets some wars with Lebanon, with Hezbollah, and with Hamas, and a lot of attack and a lot of people killing in this period, more than 200 people killing in this period from 2006 until 2007. We had our Palestinian division in 2007 between Fatah and Hamas, and more than 600 people killing in the street. In 2008, the first Israeli operation war over Gaza Strip. 2012, the second Israeli over Gaza Strip also. And the last war was in 2014. In this period, more than 10,000 of Palestinian killing and killing and killing and killing. We are, yes, we are suffering, but inside us as Palestinians, I can talk how we can still have the hope, how we can still have the dream, the goals. Any people living in this area like this, they already preparing themselves as a bomb. Mm. I have no choice when I'm talking about my dream, my goal. I can't travel, I can't think, I can't go what I want to be. Mm-hmm. For that, in the same time, the Gazans think that, I'm thinking about the people in Gaza, I'm not talking now about the political Palestinians. Mm-hmm. The Gazans think that nobody care about us. Mm-hmm. Where is my president? Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, we elected him as a president for all of Palestine. Mm. Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, his last visit for Gaza Strip was in 2006, before the election. Now we had 11 years without showing our president. There is a lot of people don't know that we have a president called Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen. Also, the Gazans said, where is Hamas? Where is Islamic Jihad? Where is Fatah? What is of all these resistant groups who are talking about the Palestinians' issues? They are just talking in the media. Mm. At the same time, also the Gazans think that America is the big evil in the world and they supported Israel all the time. I'm not talking about the American people. I'm talking about what the Gazans think. Also, Gazans think that the Europe, all of the countries, don't care about Gaza. Mm. But when Gazans succeed to travel outside Gaza Strip, There is no Gazans. I don't hear that there is any Gazans killed anybody in all over the world, in America, in Europe, in Israel. There is no Gazans. Why? Because they are already inside himself. He is believing in peace. He's believing in peace. He's believing in understanding other. He's believing in a lot of things. Yes, we had a very blood history. But at the same time, anyone came to Gaza and listened to Gazans, he will hear a lot of stories, of success stories. For example, you hear that any American had any attack in Gaza Strip, there is no American attacked or killed in Gaza Strip. So why Gaza? The Gazans, now the situation is very dangerous. It's very complicated. The people now have no choice. The people can explode towards anybody, towards Israel, toward Egypt, toward his family, toward anybody. He don't care. You can imagine when you are a young or an elder, and you don't have any money in your pocket, and your son came to you asking for you about just one shekel. It's like 10 cents, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What you gonna say? Don't have money. When you are hearing for your children and he's crying, and you don't have any money to get any milk for him. Yeah. But we are responsible for our situation as Palestinians because there is a very big gap between the Palestinian political and the Palestinian people. This division also made a very gap between Gazans and West Bank, Gazans and Jerusalem. Now Gaza, we think in Gaza that we are another country, and West Bank and other Palestinian places, other countries. If Hamas and Fatah will start continue fighting forever, they can divide this country and this Gaza for Hamas and West Bank Jerusalem for Palestine. So how we can negotiate with Israel? At the same time, yes, Israel occupy us, and at the same time, Israel support the Palestinian division. When Hamas, when Israel think that there is any closing between Hamas and Fatah, Hamas, Israel can make any attacking, can put any news in Ma'arif or Haaretz or the Israeli media show that Hamas make a blockade over Gaza, or Mahmoud Abbas will blockade Gaza also, that the people that they still fighting each other. But I'm trust in our next generation, like Jamal and like the people who will follow Jamal. The people who is, for me, for example, for me, I'm here in America since February. It's my first time since 2005 to live under straight electricity. In Gaza Strip, you can imagine if you are living in your house and there is no electricity all the time, you can you have electricity for 4 hours.
You remember last day joke?
Yeah.
We were like talking about, I have the same habit from back home that I still like, I don't charge my phones or like, it's in my mind like still some specific still, even though I have been here in America for 3 years, there's some little things. I don't charge my phone. It's like in a habit where like, oh, when it comes to that electricity, you know, we were like having fun.
We forget that we are already, there is electricity here. We are walking in the dark all the time in Gaza Strip.
In
the streets, in the homes. And even all of these hard conditions, we believe in peace. We believe that we can live together, not just with the Israelis or with any kind of people or all over the world. A lot of Palestinians here in America, you can't fight them. And my message to the American society and the American government also, come to Gaza. You are very welcome to Gaza. Come and see the real. Your reports from the embassy and from the organizations is not enough. These reports just, you know, related for any agendas also. You can't come to the street and listen to the people. What you will see, I'm not talking about any one state, two states. I'm talking about there is a people dying every day in Gaza Strip. And it's not fair. The Gazans think that the American is the most evil in the world. For my opinion, the country who had the mistake, not USA, the country is Britain. If we are want to talk about Balfour Declaration, this mistake was from Britain. Nowadays, Britain shows the world that we will recognize for Palestinian state, and the Americans, you know, show the world that also we are Gazans. We know that many countries using us as a cards, even in Arab countries, even in foreign countries.
Well, Dan, let me ask you this. We have about a minute left, but I know you're working on this documentary that will be, many will be bringing you back to talk about it, but a lot of people who are listening here are in the U.S. It's going to be a great way, I think, to hear and see a lot of what's going on in Gaza for those who don't know. So if you could just maybe talk about that just for a second, what you guys are trying to do and where people maybe, you know, should be looking for updates.
Yeah, I'm just in the final stages with Max Blumenthal of our documentary called Killing Gaza. We started shooting in the last couple weeks of the war in 2014, and then I continued to stay for about a year and a half period. I spent almost 7 months in Gaza. So basically after international media had left and people are kind of eking out their existence in the rubble, I just continued to film throughout the winter, throughout the summer, and in order to kind of show, you know, what people are surviving under this media blackout. And additionally, we get into a lot of media criticism showing how the war and aftermath were portrayed in this country. You know, you really kind of see the dissonance. And that will be finished up in the next couple of weeks, and we're going to figure out what the distribution is. But you can sign up for our newsletter at killinggaza.com. Follow me on Twitter at DanCohen3000 or Max Blumenthal at Max Blumenthal. And we'll definitely keep you updated.
Perfect. And we'll get you and Max in here when that thing drops so people who are listening to this show will definitely know what's going on with that. We are going to be out of time with our guest here, but we are so thankful to Jamal Ashour, Rami Aman, and Dan Cohen for joining us. And we are going to shift gears here in the last few minutes that we have today. We're joined by Tawanda Jones. Tawanda Jones's brother, Tyrone West, was murdered by Baltimore police. This is something that was highlighted in a recent taping of American Race on TNT. You may have seen a couple of the teasers. The official episode is coming out tomorrow at 9 p.m. on TNT. So please pay attention to that American Race. But now we turn to Tawanda Jones. Tawanda, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, of course, of course. And I think really unbelievable in some ways, the Charles Barkley documentary situation where your mother was on there. And I'm curious your take on some of how that played out, because he was trying to make some, I don't know what point he was trying to make, but I guess it's that police have to make these decisions in split seconds. And obviously, it's way more complicated than that. And your mother pointed out, I think, quite correctly that, you know, Tyrone was not killed in a split second, but in 15 minutes. I mean, your take on that exchange and also just how it relates to what happened to your brother and his other folks in Baltimore.
Yeah, so, and I'm just so glad. I'm so proud of my mom for standing up, because if she wasn't going to stand up, I definitely was, but I knew she had it covered. Mm. And that's a lot of people taking input on things like that, that it's such, or it's just a split decision and things of that nature, when the fact is that they beat my brother, like my mom echoed in volumes, that they beat him over a half an hour. Like, that's not a split decision. I'm sorry, a split decision. That's ridiculous. And then even with, like, the other crimes where you see somebody gunned down, and they're gunned down over 30 and 40 times, like, shot at. Like, I think about Keith Davis Jr., who's now on trial fighting for his life, now for a murder that, to me, was pent on him. You know what I mean? Just because it's like he survived, but now he's in jail fighting for his life. Like, that's ridiculous. So was that a split decision to shoot somebody, to shoot at Keith Davis Jr. 43 times and hit him 3 times, including in the face and neck? So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing about this that I always find so frustrated, and I'm curious your take on this, is that we hear this so often that, like, it one of the two, either just that it's a few bad apples, or the, oh, this is such a tough decision, they have to make it so quickly, even though we have so much evidence. I mean, taking just Baltimore as one example, with that consent decree, the Justice Department investigation that came out, I mean, it's so clear all the misconduct that people are facing day in, day out, the brutality, the murder, and yet and still people in the media, you know, people who are supporting the police are making these statements without one fact to back them up.
Absolutely, but at the end of the day, what I'm learning, they don't care about the facts. The fact is, like, even in my brother's execution on July 18, 2013, we had a dozen or more witnesses that will tell you that my brother was beat, pepper sprayed, stomped, kicked, tased, everything, beat, to the point that the residents couldn't even understand what they were seeing. So if you have this type of thing in videos that we see, video footage like with Freddie Gray, you see the video footage of Freddie Gray, is actually, he can't even stand up, and he's tossed, you know, into the paddy wagon like roadkill. It's ridiculous. So at the end of the day, they don't care about facts. The fact is, they don't care about us. Mm. That's just it. And then what they try to do, and that's why I try to set the record clear, and I'm glad Charles Barkley gave me the venue for me and my family to, like, set his mind clear and set America clear, is the fact that what they try to do to kind of make brutality, police brutality, set or stand, is they try to talk about community violence. That's like mixing water and oil. You can't talk about, oh, well, you guys are killing each other. And at the end of the day, we know Caucasian kill Caucasians. They don't call that Caucasian on Caucasian crime. Asians kill Asians. They don't call that Asian on Asian crime. Why is it called black on black crime? That's a way to place us in a box. And where, so if they want to come kill us, and you know, at the end of the day, if somebody executes us, and we're paying these officers to keep us safe, not to brutalize us. Mm. And that's just it. Because at the end of the day, if a constituent brutalizes or murders somebody else, and they accord and witnesses come and testify, you will never see the citizen ever again. That'll be the end of him or her. But when these officers kill, they get killed with immunity. They get killed with rewards. They get killed with rewards, and they get payment. They get paid for this. They get acknowledgement in a good way for killing a black unarmed man or black unarmed woman or black person. Period. That's ridiculous. It needs to stop. But I feel like it's not going to stop until we make a stand and say enough's enough. We got to make it stop. Right. We got to start like stepping up, stepping forward. When you see something and you know it's not right, say something and always stand strong for what you believe in. If you believe it right, I don't care if it takes you 20 years or 30 years to prove your case, stay on it. Because that's how I am with my brother's case. I promise my family, I promise Tyrone West, my big brother, that I am his keeper, and I'm going to bring all 11 to 15 animals to justice. I promise you, by all means, I'm going to bring them to justice. And if I don't, let's be clear, I'm going to have the whole entire world know that these are road cops, and please be aware because they can hurt you. Nicholas Keller Chapman and Officer Ruiz, they almost killed Abdul Salam on July the 1st. They were the first two jump out boys, and they almost killed Darrell Hurst 24 hours on July the 17th. Darrell Hurst, the same exact two repeat violent killer offenders.
Wow.
And I want every last one of them involved in my brother's brutal execution, all 11 to 15 of them, every last one of them.
Wow. That's unbelievable that these people are still on the Baltimore Police Force. Wow.
Yes, still working. And then I heard, and then for me to learn that David Wilson, I'm sorry, I can't even say the name again, David Lewis, he was the officer for Morgan after my brother was pepper sprayed, kick stomped, tased by all the 19 animals. He made sure that my brother died by standing on my brother's back with his knee in his neck. I had my brother in a prone position, face down, witnesses saw this. And David Lewis is still working. He done swindled away from West Wednesday, and he done, because he was working at IHOP. He left Morgan, and then he, like, working little, off-duty police jobs, like, working at the movie theater. Now I heard he's working in Annapolis. He has to learn to be doing police in Annapolis, checking people in or out. And you're a killer. Like, did you put killer cop on your resume? It's ridiculous.
Right. Wow. I mean, that's unbelievable. But I wanted to also, since we got a minute and a half here, roughly, West Wednesdays, talk about what you guys are doing for West Wednesdays, because I think this is one of the most, inspiring protests I see week in and week out.
Oh, I appreciate that. So West Wednesday is basically and not just a venue to get my brother's story out, but it's a venue highlighted for all the victims of police brutality and murder. We've been doing this now. This is week, as of today, this is week 198. Week 198, we've been out there nonstop, and we're not going to stop until killer cops are in cell blocks, meaning until people start getting held accountable, we're never going to stop West Wednesday.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate that. I've had a chance to be at a couple. I think it's amazing. Anyone who's in Baltimore, go to West Wednesday. I really appreciate how you guys have held it down, and I really appreciate you, Tawanda, for joining the show. That was Tawanda Jones. She's the brother of Tyrone West. He was murdered by Baltimore police, still fighting for justice in that case and many other folks in the city of Baltimore. So again, thank you, Tawanda. And that is going to do it for us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.